offering the audio via Adobe Connect. You can listen and watch the presenter. The presenters will be advancing the slides. And as you, most of you know, the materials were available to download in advance, and you're you know, recommended to participate live via the online broadcast. Anyone who has called in the phone line, we do ask that you keep your phone muted. We have globally muted all the lines and are just asking that the presenters unmute themselves so that we can hear them during their presentation. But if for some reason you do unmute us, please just don't use your hold button, because although your background music might be delightful, it's unwanted and it can be very disrupting. Throughout the seminar, we're going to be asking you for your feedback and if you have any questions and answers. And you don't have to wait till we take a break to provide us with your questions and answers. As you'll see, there's a Q&A pod in your main seminar screen here, and you can submit a question or comment to us using that pod anytime throughout the webinar. And actually, I encourage you to do that as we're going through, so that when we do get to the time for questions and answers, you know, we're ready to go and we have your questions lined up. And I just want to remind everyone that today's event is being recorded, and it will be available as an archive that can be accessed for free, and you will receive a follow-up email letting you know when that's available. So this slide is just to orient you to the Adobe Connect room. You'll see we have the slide deck where the main slides will be that the presenter will be moving you through as they are giving their presentation. There's also an audio online audio button that you can control the volume of your audio. If you find that you would like to be looking at the slides in a larger format, you can click on the full screen button at the top of your window here, and that will give you a full view of the slides. And at any time that you want to go back and minimize that, you can just hit the full screen button again, and it'll take you back to this view. Again, use the Q&A pod to submit questions as we move through. We will be taking questions after each presenter, and then, you know, as time allows, at the end of the presentation, we're going to, for those of you who were on last week, we're going to ask the audience if you want to speak about any of your site-specific issues and share any pictures and files and things like that. So with that, I think we're ready to get started with today's webinar. Our first presenter is Mark Sprenger, and Mark is an environmental scientist with EPA's Superfund environmental response team, and Mark focuses on ecological risk assessment, contaminant fate and transport, site environmental monitoring, and the assessment of innovative remedial technologies and ecological restoration from the ecological risk perspective. So Mark, if you're ready to go.
I am. I assume you can hear me?
You sound great.
Okay. Just starting out, talking about mine lands, that's obviously what we're doing. And a lot of my focus will be towards the development of alternative performance measures for remedial success. One of the things to consider, and why this is important, why it's a big deal, is really looking at larger mine sites or mine sites that are difficult because of their location. And it's important for a few reasons. One is the idea of sustainability. Because of the scale, the location of some of these sites, if you think about the site in total, there's aspects that are perhaps not sustainable, either because of the fuel use and the logistics of getting in and out of these locations, the idea of building repositories for the mine waste, and capping that material, siting the repository, bringing in the material for capping the repository, backfilling, capping, and restoring the areas where material is being removed. There's an aspect of whether or not that's really sustainable or not. You're injuring multiple locations to fix one location. Additionally, just the scale of some of these sites are problematic in terms of what you're going to do with them. There's long-term environmental impacts. As I said, citing up a repository has an impact. Harvesting soil for cover material has an impact. And there can be other impacts that are the more traditional things that we think about, truck traffic, those types of aspects, as well as perhaps loss of use of the area because of the type of remedy that's selected. If we're capping an area, we want to maintain the cap, as the integrity of the cap, and therefore that might eliminate some land use possibilities. But at the end of the day, within at least the Superfund program and remedial process, we have to select a protective remedy for the site. That's threshold criteria, one of the two threshold criteria. It needs to be protective. Traditionally, we align protectiveness with a risk level. So, if we're going to look at alternate performance measures, they're alternate to what? Well, the thing we traditionally use for performance measures for these kinds of sites, as well as most of the other ones, is a media concentration, a soil concentration. You're going to clean up to X parts per million, either as a maximum value or as an average over an exposure unit, an area, an operable unit, or we're going to cap the material so it's completely isolated. Effectively, there is no concentration above our projected risk-based number out there. But our performance ultimately is based on achieving a concentration in soil, or traditionally soil or sediment. If you go with a innovative technology, green technology, soil amendment technology, those kinds of things, you may not be really reducing the soil concentration to any appreciable extent. What your objective is to change the availability, the mobility, or the toxicity of the material, not necessarily the concentration. So that performance measure of concentration no longer is useful to you. In order to do that, though, you need to look at the future land use considerations. What's going to happen with this area? What's it going to be like? What's it like now? What's it going to be like in the future when you're finished? What do you and or other people want these things to be? In order to figure that out, you've got to bring the stakeholders in and talk to them and really do more than, I don't know if we say traditionally we do, but in kind of a different way. We traditionally talk with stakeholders and basically tell them what we see as the remedial options, what we can do with the property, rather than talking to them and having them tell us what they want from the property, other than, quotes, they want it remediated, which is kind of a given. But bringing them in, really getting them to be part of the process, and that's absolutely key in terms of having any success with doing these approaches, because they have to buy into multiple things, the end land use, and they have to buy into the performance measures. If they don't, you're not going anywhere with this. Also, we need to consider reuses of the mining waste as well as the mine lands. Traditionally, there's been fairly limited options on that, at least that I have seen. Reworking tailings to do further extraction is a possibility that they'll be taken to another facility and a newer extraction technique utilized on them. But perhaps there's other things that can be done with some of the waste material that's on site, either using it within the amendment mix because it's not contaminated the same way as the other material, or it could be used for off-site uses. For example, there has been mine waste used as material and concrete production as aggregate or roadbed material, things of that nature where it's not there isn't an exposure, but there's some economic value to be gained from utilizing it. So those need to be explored fully, because the less you have to do anything with, the better off everybody else is. So what do we need to do? Well, basically what we need to do is build on what we already do. Everything you hear me talking about in one way, shape, or form is things that we already do within the remedial process. It's just a matter of we're doing them slightly differently, perhaps in a little bit more detail or with a slightly different focus. So if we want to look at alternate performance measures, alternate technologies, we need to think about and do a number of things. Not anything new, just have to do it a little bit differently. The performance measures that we ultimately get have to be consistent with the site use, the end site use. And that's critical. And that goes back to looking at what the site uses are going to be. What is this property going to be like? What are the environmental conditions that are going to exist after we are finished? And the performance measures need to be consistent with that. As well as then, they need to meet the expectations of the stakeholders. And that's critical in that whole stakeholder involvement of what the expectations are. There have to be realistic expectations by everyone involved. If they are not realistic or have not considered what the proposed remedy really is, again, you'd end up with failure, and I'll speak a little bit of that later on. So basically, we're going to approach things differently. We're going to take the picture on the left, which is Palmerton Zinc Hillside, and we're going to put amendments in it, and we're going to revegetate it, and you get the property on the right-hand side. That's basically the same location. So we've made it look a whole lot better. We got things growing on it. And how are we going to say whether or not that was a good thing to do? What's the performance measure? Where are we going to go with this? Well, as I said, we start thinking about land use. In that case, we're talking about open space. That area along the top of the ridge in Palmerton is recreational access. The Appalachian Trail runs right through it, comes down the hillside. In this example, this is up in Leadville, Colorado, part of the California Gulch site along the upper Arkansas River. Those two photographs are, in fact, the same location. And the land use in this instance was for rangeland, agricultural use. That was the desired use of that piece of property. It's floodplain. And you note on the bottom that right now, by and large, we're not thinking in terms of residential property and human health risks. Some instances, it may not make a big difference depending on the contaminant we're working at. Frequently on mining lands, we're dealing with arsenic and or lead in one way, shape, or form. Those two in particular give us a fair amount of heartache with human health issues and exposure. So we need to think about that. I mean, are we really talking about these areas becoming residential properties? And if they are, then perhaps, depending on the contaminants, this isn't the way we're going to go. So again, thinking about land use. We need to determine the risk through the risk assessment a number of things. We need to know which contaminants are causing the risk, and they're the dominant factors, and why they're causing the risk, and whether or not those risks may change in the future, either the risk from those contaminants or risk from contaminants that are currently not a problem but might be in a different environmental setting, the setting that we create. And focus on that because, especially at mining sites, we run into a slew of contaminants, a slew of elements that come up within as potentially causing adverse effects, way above screening level values. And you look at the whole laundry list and you go, okay, well, how do I know what to focus on? That's the issue that needs to be worked on. Which ones are really important? Do I really care whether or not the barium concentration is high or not? Or am I really just concerned about the zinc levels and the cadmium levels? And that barium just, yeah, I'm going to have to pay attention to it, but that's really what I don't need to focus on that. And then you need to gather information to justify that what information we would need after you do the remedy that would justify and demonstrate that the remedy was in fact protective. In this case, we're talking just basically what do we do that identifies risk reduction. So that's basically where we're going. We're saying that the risk assessment is a tool that's going to equate to and give us access to remedy performance measures. We're going to use the risk assessment not just here's the contaminants that cause risk, here's the threshold for adverse effects as the contaminants stand in the field right now, but we're going to look at it in terms of what we did and how we did the risk assessment to use those same tools to develop performance measures. And in general, what we're going to be saying is that acceptable residual risk, that's critical, acceptable residual risk equals successful remedy, as opposed to X soil concentration of this metal equals successful remedy. Again, another, just an illustration, those are the same spot at Bunker Hill and West Page Swamp. So, the thing to remember with this is that when we do the amendment type technologies, these other things, these are active processes. We're not going in and simply just tilling up the soil and planting some things and watching it to see it naturally recovered, monitor natural processes, that it's simply diluting. This is something that's very active. We need to know what the contaminants are doing. We need to know what the chemistry is, and we'll be going through that in general. But we need to understand that and be actively moving towards something, not passively looking at it and saying, oh, looks okay to me. That's not acceptable. We need to understand. We need to use science and a thorough process in order to demonstrate that we are, in fact, doing a remedy, not just growing things and making things look nice. Within that, we have a number of challenges because the site impacts at many of the mining sites are very obvious. I use the phrase, it's about as easy as falling off a chair to do the risk assessment and demonstrate impact. However, what's causing the impacts, what's resulted, what caused the things that we see can be quite challenging, and they're interrelated, and we need to understand those things in order to develop an effective remedy. We can have simple soil loss. If the soil's gone, you're not going to have vegetation, you're going to have erosion, you're going to have changes in chemical form of the contaminants that are there. Bad things are going to happen. But is it really because the soil's gone? Is it because of something else in any particular location as it currently exists? We can have waste rock, overburden. These materials may not be heavily contaminated. It may not have much in the way of contaminants at all. Could be just rocks and barren material that has no nutrients and it has no water holding capacity, and you're just not going to be able to do much with it. It's impacted, it's mine scarred, but it's not a contaminant problem within these areas. Then you can have tailings materials in varying forms. On the left is referred to as chat out in the tri-state mining district. Or you can have things like they refer to as slimes, as a picture of the, along the Clark Fork in Montana. These have physical aspects that impede remediation, but they're also contaminated. And then those contaminants are going to impede remediation, and we're going to have to deal with both things. And then we can have other things going on related to mining. We can have mine discharges. It can be added discharges with low pHs. It can be discharges that maybe aren't that acidic or have that much acid generation, but tons of iron flocculating out on the bottom, as in this picture, where the bottom of the stream is just smothered with iron oxides. So we can have the physical impacts, we can have the pH, a lot of things could be going on. And then we have the issue of scale. Mining sites can be on almost any scale, and each one presents its own problems. As illustrations, the upper left picture is a Midnight Mine, uranium mine outside of Spokane, very large area, and you can see other mines in the distance if you blow up that picture. The lower left is Tar Creek, Tri-State Mining District, just mind-bogglingly large piles of tailings chat, or they can be relatively small and come into residential areas. The picture on the upper right is at the East Helena site and is a residential property. As I said, that can present its own challenges with the human exposure, but it's a completely different scale. Or the bottom right-hand picture, that's McClure Mine in Arizona, if I remember correctly, small mining operations within forest, national forest. They're remote, but they're small. So we have all different sizes that can present their own issues in terms of materials handling and whatever. And then additionally, the way the contaminants are released can vary between the locations as well. You can have atmospheric releases, like the picture of Palmerton Zinc there on the upper right, where you have stack emissions, small particles, typically very available material, highly toxic for the concentrations. You can have water transport, as happened in California Gulch, with the water transporting the tailings along the gulch to the Arkansas River and then re-entrainment during erosion events. You can have placement of the materials, like the Big River site there on the left side. That's a tailings pile that's, in fact, a vehicle driving along the ridge of that tailings pile. That there's a physical problem and a size problem with that, but it was placed there and disposed of there, and you have a disposal area. Or you could have surface discharges, which may have a component of dissolved material as well as a component of suspended and or eroding material. So how it was released, there is a issue of the chemical form during the release and how it gets to where it ultimately is deposited and whether or not it's in an aquatic or a terrestrial environment. Why is all that important? Because our remedy options have to consider those things, because they are different. They are different challenges for chemical form and how we might be able to treat those materials to reduce the risks. So we're thinking about the fate in the transport, the scale, the impacts that are currently there, and then the risks that any of those components will be presenting. And they can vary across the site, because on any particular site, you can have the smelter area with the emissions, you can have the processing area with the tailings release, and you can have the actual mine itself with the waste rock and overburden and mine runoff. So all these could come into play on any given site and or on the same site. So how are we going to get at all this? And again, we're building on things. We're not necessarily doing something that we don't normally do. Well, one of the places, the RI, we do the risk assessment. That's going to give us a lot of the information. And then the nature and extent of contamination. Where are the contaminants? Where are they located? That's really what we need. Two things we always do in a remedial investigation. We just have to look at them a little bit more detail and in a little bit different way than we typically do. Because we want to know the chemical form and fate and how they're being transported, where in many instances maybe we haven't done that in the past. We know it's lead, but we haven't cared whether or not it was lead oxide or lead pyromorphite. Now we want to know that. We want to know what the chemical forms are, and that is going to take some extra work. So, circling back through what I just said, is we want to know we have the observed impacts and or the risks that we can see and or demonstrate, but we need to know whether which of those are physical impacts and physical constraints, which of them are agronomic. Is it the water holding capacity and the lack of nutrients, like in a waste rock? And it's not really a contaminant effect. Looks exactly the same as zinc toxicity or some of the other phytotoxin properties, but it really has nothing to do with anything other than the plant can't get water year-round, therefore it dies, just like our potted plants or my potted plants in the window when I forget to water them. They end up dying. Or is it in fact contaminant dominated, and then which contaminants is responsible? What are the current chemical forms? We need to know what they currently are so that we can alter the chemical forms to a less toxic form, and we need to know what would change them now actively and what might change them that we did not necessarily intend. That they may become more available, other ones may become more available or toxic, and we need to think about that. I'll talk about that a little bit more, but that's what we need to think about into the future and land use. What are these things going to do? One of the best examples is when you have lead and arsenic. Kirk may talk a little bit about this in more detail. Lead, we typically want to raise the pH. You get the pH too high, and all of a sudden the arsenic becomes more available. So we need to think about what the different contaminants that are present are going to do under the different conditions that we are going to try and create. Excuse me. So we need to know which contaminants, metals primarily, are toxic. And we also need to know where they're toxic and to what organisms. Basically, the assessment endpoints for those of you who deal in the eco-risk world. Those are the things we're interested in, the things we value that we're trying to protect at the particular site. So we need to identify those things and understand which contaminants are important to which assessment endpoints, because they're not all equally important. Plants typically do not care about lead at all. They care a lot about zinc and copper and a few other things, but not about lead, not necessarily about cadmium either for the most part. But the organisms that eat the plants probably are concerned about the cadmium. So we need to know which assessment endpoint, which contaminant, in which setting are the things that we need to focus on and get corrected, and or what we're going to have at the end so we don't create a problem. And that's whether where they'd move into what receptors, and what receptors may be there in the future that are not there now. So again, we have observed impacts. We have piles of chat and waste material, and from that we should be able to get the current chemical form. And then we have to think about what it's doing and where those chemicals are going. Examples. These are all aquatic systems that we're looking at here. Yeah, on the left, you have California Gulch. You can see some muddied water on the right-hand bank looking upstream. That's where the gulch enters into the upper Arkansas, right at that post. And that's silty, muddy water coming down the gulch that's contaminated, coming into the upper Arkansas. That's a transport mechanism, bulk transport of particles, primarily fine and coarse-grained tailings materials. In the middle, we had impacted stream at the base of the facility at Palmerton in Pennsylvania. However, there was contaminated sediments, but what appeared to be really driving the impact in the stream was discharging groundwater that had dissolved metals in it that was picking up those metals as the groundwater moved through the material coming down into the stream off of the mountainside. So very different. Still worried about the same contaminants in those instances, and these all hit very similar, but a very different transport mechanism to creating the risk and where the contaminants were going. The final right-hand side, it was from Marathon Battery. That yellow you see at the base of that core is, in fact, cadmium sulfide. That material in that section of the core is roughly 12 to 14% cadmium by mass, dry weight, and about an equal amount of nickel sulfide. In this instance, the discharges went into a wetland that was highly reducing a lot of organic matter and available sulfur, and you had the nickel and cadmium precipitated out as sulfides into the sediments. So again, understanding where it's going to go. Then, as we said, the assessment endpoints, what we're going to evaluate, where the risk is going to be, we need to think again about which contaminants where. Cadmium through the food chain, that's primarily where we're going to worry about it, moving up through the food chain to maybe to something like the osprey that's in that that nest there on the side, or maybe it's lead we're concerned about, then we're going to be worried about ingestion of sediment or soil, because food chain dietary transport isn't really all that effective for lead. But if you're ingesting large amounts of contaminated sediment, it can be very unhealthy for you. Birds, Coeur d'Alene River with the ducks each year, the waterfowl of it die. It's ingestion of sediment, not ingestion of contaminated food. Or, as in this the next picture is Palmerton again, it could be copper and zinc in the water, and aquatic species are very sensitive to copper and zinc. Birds and mammals, much less so. But if you're a fish, you don't want extra copper and zinc in the water. If you're a plant, you don't want a lot of excess zinc or copper. It can be toxic. And the last one is for assessment endpoints, is there can be species of particular concern to stakeholders, whether those be local community or trustee type groups. And we may need to include those. Our initial reaction may be that they are not particularly relevant, either because we don't believe the exposure is going to be that high, or for, because of their mobility or other things. But if for no other reason, they need to be seriously considered and done to in order to have credibility with stakeholders. This is a picture of one of the flatfish out in the west coast, one of the creosote sites. Fish are a big deal. We may not be concerned about them. They were evaluated, see if it's a, if it's really a problem, if they can be used and used effectively. In the Midwest and the Great Lakes area, things like walleye are very important. They may or may not be adversely affected by our site, but the fact that we're willing to do them and do them seriously gains credibility, if nothing else. So we're going to establish performance measures. We're looking at risk reduction as the means of demonstrating that we are protective, and we have ways of doing that. We can measure toxicity, we can measure contaminant mobility, and we could use those as options for performance measures. Direct toxicity tests, or maybe like the PBET, the physiologically based extraction procedure, some kind of chemical procedure, as a cost savings or as a way that we can do pre-post evaluation. But we can use those to demonstrate reduced toxicity and mobility. In addition, the risk assessment should be the basis, because it's telling us the chemical forms, the toxic mechanisms, and the receptors we need to be worried about, the assessment endpoints. It can be the basis of our performance measures. It's carrying through into our post-remedy evaluation and our design of the remedy. And it also becomes the baseline for our performance. We're going to use it multiple times. So while we may be having to do some additional work, which may cost some additional money, we're going to be reusing that information, and therefore, thereby, it becomes cost-effective to do those things. It's not just a, oh, you do the risk assessment, you get this stuff, you're done with it, okay, file it in the site repository, and let's move on to the next thing. No, that stays as an active part within the process, because we're going to be using that and using the information throughout the process. And then the other thing with establishing the performance measures is the community acceptability. That's going to remain an issue. People have to accept what you're doing. They have to buy into it. They have to understand that you really do understand what the contaminants are, why they're affecting the things that they're affecting, and how what you're doing is actually going to change that. They have to understand it. They may not have to get in and do the in-depth chemistry and understand all the chemistry, but they have to be at least confident that you know what you're doing and you're taking everything seriously and you're not just selling them a bill of goods. In order to do that, you need to have them engaged, or at least a subgroup of them. They have to be actively involved in it to see what you're doing, how you're doing it, and actively taking their input. And that can be a challenge at times, if not most times, but it is critical in success. So a couple of illustrations for performance measures. This is a standard earthworm toxicity test. These were results that were done when we did pilot scale tests at the Upper Arkansas River, California Gulch. You can see the untreated materials, zero survivorship. It just kills everything. It kills everything really fast, or at least it did. Treated 1 year after treatment, that was the results. Primarily everything lived. You can see one in there, there was a glitch. We went back and resolved that. But that demonstrates that it in fact worked. The tailings were no longer toxic after they were treated. So we said some contaminants aren't direct toxins. We're worried about food chain. Well, that may require some bioaccumulation studies. You may have done those within the baseline risk assessment. They would be good to do, but sometimes they're a challenge to do before you do the remedy at mining sites. If it's unvegetated, there's nothing living there. There's nothing living there to collect and analyze to demonstrate the availability, and you have to come up with some other way of evaluating that. But once you get a community reestablished and you got your remedy going, you could do simple things like catching small mammals, looking at availability to demonstrate that the availability is reduced and that your remedy is performing as designed. Plant communities. Those are a very good tool because we want revegetation for a lot of reasons. And those can become our performance measures. We can do things like plant community studies, species diversity, things of that nature, health, plant density, and biomass, how much mass of above-ground biomass is produced, how deep do the roots grow. A lot of those things seem very academic, especially to the general public. But you can take those and put those into practical terms for people. Why is biomass important? Well, if you're a farmer and you want the area for rangeland or you want to hay it, as we did at the Upper Arkansas, then biomass production is critical. And that's what the property owner wanted, was he wanted the area for rangeland. So biomass was critical. And the added benefit was, it says when it's revegetated, we reduce erosion, both wind erosion and water erosion, and therefore we reduce the transport of the contaminants off of the land, off of the floodplain, into the river, and get another benefit out of it. So we can use a single performance measure and get multiple pathways of release and risk reduction from a single performance measure. Some things you need to really sit and think about. The one I did not measure is accumulation above background. As I said in the beginning, with soil amendment technology at least, you're not really changing the soil concentration. Bulk media concentrations aren't going to be useful to you as a performance measure because they don't really change. That also means that there is going to be some amount of accumulation above background. So if your stakeholders, if somebody in the process says that their performance measure is no accumulation above background or no concentration above background, you can't do this. Those are going to happen. What you're trying to get is the second bullet is the risk unacceptable or is it acceptable? Is it acceptable for the land use? And if it is acceptable, there may be some, but is it still protective? And it can be, then your remedy is successful. The other thing people throw up, say, well, it's going to be an attractive nuisance. You're going to bring in new things. You've now created habitat. You're going to have other organisms coming in. They're going to utilize it, and to their detriment. Well, that's what all of our land use planning was about. We thought about what the land use was going to be, what things were going to come in and could be exposed there, and which contaminants would they be exposed to? And we have thought about and evaluated to make sure that the chemical form and the toxicity was not going to be such so that they would come in and be adversely affected. So there should be no attractive nuisance, because we were thinking about that and evaluating that and dealing with it from the very beginning. And then lastly, through all those things, it's stakeholder buy-in. Do the property owners buy into this? Do the resource agencies buy into this and accept this? And if they do, you need to know that before you enter into or if they don't, you need to know about that before you implement the remedy, and either try and convince them, or you're going to have to come up with a different remedy. So land use is critical. On the left, you got encroaching housing. Depending on the contaminants, that may not be where you want to go. If it's going to be open space, recreational use, those kinds of things, it may be very accessible, acceptable. It means working with people. It means finding out what they want and working with them to get them to have a realistic expectation of what's going to be done, what the land use possibilities are going to be, and what's going to be there in the future. As an example to illustrate how you might want to go about doing some of these things, this is very non-technical. What I've been talking about is, you know, fairly on the technical side. We're involved with an effort at the East Helena site in Montana. The site is around 2,000 acres. You got about a 600-acre facility area, a slag pile, and some undeveloped or currently undeveloped fields that were used as repositories for residential property removal actions and or were contaminated by atmospheric deposition from the lead smelting. You have a residential area in the center, and there's a lot of pressure for residential development use, as well as a light industry development and use and or rangeland. Well, we need to find out what people want to do rather than telling them. So what was done was a reuse charrette. Basically got all the stakeholders, the local people, property owners, as well as people involved in businesses in the community, mayor, the principal from the local school, in for a multi-day meeting where they sat around, facilitated by us, not run by EPA. I was there. I was there as a technical resource. I answered a couple of questions over the course of 2 days. I did no presentations, no formal presentations to the group, at least none that I can remember, and basically sat there and listened and was there for the group, as were a number of other people. But they sat and they figured out what they wanted out of the land, what they wanted to see happen in their community, how they wanted to see the land used. And this was an amazing process to see this happening, because you had people with very different views of what needed to be done, from natural resource groups, Fish and Wildlife Service type approach in this area, farmers, rangeland, people who were in town, wanted to develop a light industry, with very different ideas of what they needed and wanted. And they came up with some really interesting ideas and perspectives. What they ultimately came up with was the idea that they could take this property, it's difficult to see with all this, but with basically a green corridor, an environmental corridor along the creek, with a wetland complex area and a bike path along it, because it'd be a very nice place to go bicycle riding and or fishing, with reestablishing some fishing or hiking. And you could develop a trailhead near one of the old facility areas, because there are some interesting historical aspects, which would be a place where people could go and look at the historical aspects of the town. They could then go for a bicycle ride or a walk. That would take them into close proximity with local businesses, where there would spur economic development for the businesses. And certain areas could be developed for light industry. And this could all be done very reasonably, and it could direct us in remedy selection of what we needed to do in what areas. And we got this from them coming up with the ideas, and rather than us trying to tell them what they would have for land uses. So, basically in summary, big consideration, one of the primary things, we need to look at what the land use is going to be. What are these areas going to be? Are they going to be open space? Are they going to be aquatic? Are they going to be terrestrial? Are they going to be hillsides? Where are they going to be? We need to get the stakeholders in and talking with them to get their input and to get their buy-in in order to be able to have this be successful. We need to think about reuses of things just to decrease cost, and or whether or not we can turn some of the current waste material into something we can actually use either within the remedy and decrease our costs, or that it can be of some kind of profit to the community. Everybody would love that to happen. Doesn't always happen, but it's something that does need to be pursued. We need to make sure that the remedy is protective. That's threshold criteria. Ultimately, for the final remedy, if you are the site manager, you need to say within your final decision document, the remedy is protective of human health, welfare, and the environment. If you can't say that, you're not at final remedy. So those things, and then we need to look at alternate performance measures, because if we're not digging it up and hauling it away, or we're not putting it in a repository and covering it up with a foot or 2 feet of topsoil, and then bringing in new material to redo the land surface, we need something other than media concentrations as a performance measure to say that we have a protective remedy in the end. And with that, I think I am finished.
Great. Thanks, Mark. I think we can take a couple questions before we move into the next presentation. So anyone who has any questions, I encourage you to submit them using the Q&A pod, which is in the bottom right-hand corner of your Adobe Connect Room screen. And I will gladly read your question to Mark. So please submit questions. And we do have a couple that came in while you were speaking, Mark. If you're ready, I can read some of them to you.
That would be good. I just have a little bit of difficulty reading the questions, so that would
no
be
problem.
Good if you could read them.
Sure. So one questioner wants to know, how do you factor in the extent of contamination in interpreting ecological risks?
I'm trying to formulate that quick. Some contaminants, terrestrially, it seems to be less of an issue. But you have some contaminants, like, for example, mercury, which can have, since that's a very strong, at least once it's methylating, is a very strong bioaccumulating. And you can have a component of the net transport of the contaminant into the ecosystem that's area-based versus necessarily concentration-based. Because at least in the example of mercury, the methylation process is biologically driven, not contaminant driven. So it really depends on the contaminant, whether or not the area is, how much of a factor it is. What is more, although somewhat controversial yet, but is valid, is looking at the area and saying, how is that area utilized by the resources, the assessment endpoints, the receptors within the area. You can have very high concentrations in an area that would be toxic to, say, a bird, but if the birds don't go there now, if there's no reason for them to go there, there's no food, water, or shelter, then there probably is very little exposure. Now, once you're thinking in the future land use, saying, okay, well, if I don't change the concentration, but now I make it into something that's attractive to them, now maybe I have a problem. Now I have to look at the chemical form and I have to integrate those things. But that whole issue of area-weighted averaging of concentrations, it's something that needs to be thought through, evaluated. There is more likely in our instance, and from this context, it's a look at the areas of whether or not it is realistic to say an organism will or will not use that location. And I would put it more in a black and white category like that than gray, because there's a whole debatable set of arguments on area use and what that means relative to the toxicity reference values. So it's a tricky topic. I'm not sure if I completely answered the question or not.
Well, someone asked the question I think might be a follow-up to that, is if you knew of any methods or studies available to help monitor the post-remedy bioaccumulation, and I guess in particular they wanted to know about small mammals. Are there any studies that you can direct people to look at?
There isn't a huge amount in the literature, in primary literature. We have done small mammals in pilot scale in Tri-State Mining District. Did small mammal collection there. There's data that's been generated, again, not published in primary literature, at Palmerton Zinc, looking at small mammal populations and whether or not the contaminants are moving in or not. We did work like that in California Gulch as well. The one difficulty in pre-post comparison is that a lot of these areas, as I had said, they're very sparsely to non-vegetated, so that you don't have the small mammal populations or other things to do the precondition baseline evaluation. That tends to be a challenge. Once you revegetate it, then depending on how you revegetated, how you restored the area, what you made it into, that'll determine what moves back in and what's there. And at least for small mammals, our experience has been they move in like crazy. Palmerton Zinc, when we did some trapping there on the Blue Mountain hillside, you could hear the traps going off before you left the trapping area. We had the same thing happen out in Jasper County. It's available habitat. They move in quickly. Your big question, I think, is going to be more of that, which contaminants are you looking at, and is the pathway to the small mammals the right pathway to look at? Is it the most cost-effective way of doing it?
Okay. We had gotten a follow-up comment that Texas Tech did a small mammal and bird evaluation on treated lands and non-treated at the Anaconda smelter site, and then apparently that data is available via the site RPM, which you could find on EPA's webpage.
The folks at Texas Tech have done a lot of that work.
Yeah. So that might be a good place for the audience to search for that information.
And if I can remember the name of the primary author before the phone call ends, I'll say it. I can't bring up his name off the top of my head.
Okay. So I think there's a two-part question here. Do contaminants limit the plant species that can be established on in-place treatment sites? And then I would say a follow-up to that is, are the contaminants in the vegetation potentially toxic to receptors?
Okay. The way you treat the land is and which contaminants are there is going to determine what you can grow there. I unfortunately was not able to participate in the first of this series, but the folks on that call, Rufus Cheney and Sally Brown, as well as many others, could go into much greater detail than I can on those aspects. But what pH you want it to be, and for the metals and mobility, and the environmental setting of your area are largely going to determine what ultimately is there, unless it's being used as agricultural land. So If you're doing an amendment mix that limits plant growth, you either aren't doing it right or it's by decision, that you're making it so that it is grassland and you're developing it as grassland, and those particular species that you're trying to make sure can grow. Usually you want a native species, again, unless it's agricultural in nature, in which case it's going to be whatever is planted. In terms of the contaminant loading in the plant and the secondary risk, that's part of your active process, and you have to think that through. Will the contaminants move into the food chain through the plants to an extent where they will generate a risk to a consumer of the plant? Largely, and that's where you have to think about different contaminants, because as I said, for plants, it's not uncommon for zinc to be the causative agent, of toxic agent, that's limiting plant growth. That can be easily corrected in the soil with pH adjustment and a few other things. Rufus and Sally and other folks can go into that in greater detail of the chemistry of that to make sure that that's occurring. But then you got the plants growing. Now you may have the question of, okay, is now that the plants are growing, is the lead within the soil, which the plant really doesn't care about from a toxicity standpoint, going to accumulate in the plant itself, and now the rabbit or the small mammal that eats those things, or the deer, are they going to be at risk for consumption? Mm-hmm. That's what you need to look at in terms of then evaluate the availability of the lead through that pathway. And the answer is you got to evaluate it. You got to demonstrate that in fact, the availability has been reduced. Our experience with lead is you can very easily with lead get that availability reduced so that it is not a problem, but you still need to be able to evaluate it. In the end, if it were to be a risk, then your amendment was not successful, because it is not then an unacceptable risk, that residual risk. Therefore, it's not a protective remedy. Therefore, that remedy failed.
Right. Okay. And Mark, it looks like the name of that researcher is Mike Hooper.
Yep, Mike Hooper. Yes. Thank you very much, Dennis.
Okay. Well, I think in the essence of time, we'll move on to our next presentation, but we'll remind everyone we will open it up for discussion and questions at the end of today's presentations. And we will also be discussing more site-specific issues with Roger Hoogerheide from Region 8 when he talks about his mine site that he's working on. So our next presenter is Kirk Scheckel, who is a research soil scientist in EPA's Office of Research and Development. Kirk focuses on solving fundamental issues regarding element speciation in soils, sediments, and water in order to understand reaction mechanisms that influence fate in the natural environment. So, Kirk, I see that you have figured out how to use the pointer.
I believe so.
You should be good to go.
Great. Thank you, Michelle. So, again, the title of my talk is Immobilization Strategies for Lead and Arsenic. And the emphasis for what I'll talk about today is more on the human health side, working with communities directly, and not too much on the ecological side of small organisms, but obviously an important aspect as well. I'd like to start out by just acknowledging my collaborators. Brad Miller is a postdoc working with me, and Karen Bradham is in our NERL office of EPA down in North Carolina, along with Dave Thomas in the NHERL division. So again, as I mentioned, the concept here that I'll discuss is dealing with high human contact soils. And this is a significant issue, and most often than not, we're dealing with urban or suburban soils, which are very challenging for remediation. Obviously, there's the environmental aspect that we have to deal with. In many cases, lead's a common contaminant in soils, and we can clean up or remediate those soils, but if we don't take care of the source, which may be lead-based paint peeling off the house, then we're going to accomplish very little. There's economical and social aspects to consider. There's a number of studies that have shown a link between urban areas with high crime rates, and there's hints that there's a linkage towards blood lead levels tying into that. There's also a loss of future income as a result of detrimental effects of lead taken up into small children later on in life. So those are some considerations we need to push forward in terms of remediating soils to improve the quality of health in these areas. However, as a result, you know, our most common recommendation in these situations is soil removal. And while that may be good in practice, we quickly find that the costs often nullify this recommendation. These communities just do not have the funds to do this on a regular basis. And then, as a result, these residents continue to live in these contaminated environments. So the question becomes, you know, what alternatives are available to assist these communities? And today I'm going to talk to you a little bit about soil metal immobilization or in-situ remediation or whatever term you'd like to use. But you know, the premise of this work is to treat the soil in place at the site in its natural or original position. And Mark alluded to this a little bit, and this is kind of a premise of what Rufus and Sally talked about last week with the organic amendments that they were covering. So in-situ immobilization is the process of transforming a metal contaminant into three key characteristics. It must be non-bioavailable, it should be non-soluble, and it should be non-transportable in a soil matrix so that the soil is safer and does not warrant removal. Fortunately, there's a number of amending agents available for in-situ remediation. However, it requires an understanding of the soil chemistry so that you know, we're gaining maximum efficiency and effectiveness when we do this. And this is an issue that we've run into in the past for a number of field studies. Of course, there's advantages and disadvantages to everything in terms of soil metal immobilization. Advantages include, you know, minimal site disturbance. You typically have much lower capital costs versus dig and haul. If the right amendment is chosen, you can promote a sustainable or a green initiative. There's generally very high public acceptance once the public understands the risk and the benefits of in-situ remediation. It takes a little bit to get that education across to demonstrate the approach is going to be beneficial to them. And it's better than, in most cases, it's at least doing something, whereas if we don't even do dig and haul, they continue to live in those contaminated environments. And as I mentioned before, there's a variety of amending agents available to suit your site. The disadvantages, obviously, is that the contaminant is still in the soil. And again, goes back to the educational component that it must be addressed that residents understand that concept. But it also turns into requirements of long-term monitoring to ensure that the conversion of that contaminant to something that we think is non-bioavailable and insoluble is that way in the long term as well. So we've had very successful bench studies. It's very easy to show there. However, some field results are quite mixed, and I think that's not necessarily a case of the remediation aspect itself. It's a lack of understanding of the soil chemistry in which the technology is applied. So in the case of lead, there's a number of options. And I'm including in here in this list as well as the work that Sally and Rufus talked about last week. But some other things we can consider, if we have a sediment environment, one can induce sulfate reduction to form galena, which is lead sulfide, a very insoluble form of lead that would be retained in a sediment environment quite well. In the literature, it's been suggested that one could add molybdenum to soils to form wolfenite, which is, again, a very insoluble lead mineral. And a more common approach, though, is the addition of phosphate to soils to form pyromorphite. In the chemical formula shown here, it's almost identical to the chemical formula of teeth and bone, except you have lead rather than calcium. Now, of these three, I would typically not recommend adding molybdenum to soils. For arsenic, there's a couple other options we can consider. First of all, there's been a number of studies looking at amendments with high iron, manganese, or aluminum oxides as a soil amendment. And these make perfect sense. You have materials that have a high sorption capacity that can retain arsenic at very high levels, would definitely be beneficial. In some high pH soils where there's a lot of calcium, you could potentially form calcium arsenates. However, again, this goes back to the long-term monitoring aspect that if you have a tremendous shift in equilibrium of pH in that system, you could potentially have a release of arsenic resulting from that. So relying on that as a remediation strategy probably is not wise as well. So in terms of lead immobilization, the simplified equation is shown here. We have a contaminated soil, we add phosphate material, and we form pyromorphite. Shown here are some gem quality examples of pyromorphite. You would probably not find crystals like this in your soil if you do a phosphate amendment, but just to give you an example. The material, or pyromorphite, was first discovered in the late 1700s in Wales, and it was called initially green lead ore. It forms naturally through the reaction of galena oxidation in the proximity of organic matter, which is high in phosphorus in itself. And the neat thing about this is for its use in soils, it's actually a borrowed technology from drinking water. It was very common in the late 1800s and all the way up till today to utilize orthophosphate in drinking water to form a passivating film or a pipe scale on the interior portion of lead pipes to reduce any lead release in the drinking water. So it makes perfect sense that it's a viable technology. Now, the fun part in doing immobilization research is to use common sense or use logic in the immobilization. And shown in this figure are three curves. The black curve represents lead absorption or an isotherm for lead absorption. So at a very low pH, there's very little lead absorbed in a soil matrix. So in acidic soils, you have a lot more lead that's available or that's mobile. And then as pH increases slightly, you all of a sudden hit like a jump, if you will, and you see absorption go up very rapidly as a function of pH and then levels off. Now, to understand this is that at high pH, lead is retained very highly on soils. At low pH, it's very labile. Now, in terms of calcium phosphate shown here with the red curve, you have a narrow range from about pH 6 to 9, where if there's an abundant amount of calcium and an abundant amount of phosphorus in soil, you can form calcium phosphates. And this philosophy follows down to the blue curve, which represents iron, aluminum, manganese phosphates that can form over a pH range of about 3 to 7. Now, our objective here for immobilization is to get these materials to react. So if we add lead, or if we have lead in our soil and we add phosphorus, we want these two to interact to form pyromorphite. Now, if we add a very soluble form of phosphorus and we have a very non-labile form of lead, the phosphorus will start to encapsulate those lead particles, and you still have the original form of lead that's encapsulated now with a pyromorphite crust, if you will. Now, the form of lead that's inside that capsule may potentially still be bioavailable. Likewise, if you have a highly available lead and you put a non-labile form of phosphorus, such as phosphate rock, you can have lead coating that phosphate particle. Now, the objective, or what we'd like to see, is moving lead and phosphorus either into the soil solution or into labile forms where they're easily available for reaction. Now, most soils tend to have a pH of about 6.5 or so, somewhere between 6 and 7, and at that particular pH, you could look here on the figure again, that lead absorption is quite high, or highly retained there. However, we start to reach some minimization of the formation of iron, aluminum, manganese phosphates and calcium phosphates. If we look at a lower pH, let's say down around 4, we have a lot more lead that's not retained in the soil matrix, and we have kind of a decline of iron, aluminum, and manganese phosphates, which may be a more ripe opportunity to enhance the formation of pyromorphite in that system. So some of the thought that we have behind this is if we can take a lead-contaminated soil that, let's say, has a pH of 6.5, and if we can first lower the pH to less than 4, and that can be done through a number of soil acidifying agents, then add phosphate, allow time to react to form pyromorphite, which, you know, again, this would be dependent on some bench studies to determine how much time is necessary. Increase the pH back up to 6 and establish a vegetative cover to form an additional barrier between children playing on the front lawn, for example. So we're testing this technology out in the laboratory to try to enhance it, but in the past, we've had success in terms of lead immobilization in soils. And shown here is a citation for what I would call the Joplin study. There was about three or four phosphate immobilization studies conducted in the Joplin, Missouri area in the late 90s. This is one that was led by Jim Ryan, and Rufus Cheney was involved with it. Bill Birdie from DuPont, Sally was there as well. And it was a very encompassing research project in which several amendment types, which are shown here, were added in a randomized block design in a vacant lot near a lead smelter. So we had our control, and then we had amendments that were phosphorus only, which included triple superphosphate, phosphate rock, and phosphoric acid. We had combinations of phosphorus with an iron material, which was an iron-rich residue or a waste product that was high in iron, in different combinations with triple superphosphate. And then additionally, we followed up with phosphorus additions to a composted biosolid, either independently by itself or in tandem with triple superphosphate. Now, some of the results of this work suggest that we're finding a significant reduction of lead bioavailability in that system. And that information is shown here in this table. After the soils were reacted, we collected samples periodically and conducted animal feeding studies, as well as in vitro extractions. Mark was alluding to this a little bit. These in vitro extractions are designed to mimic the release of lead in the gastrointestinal phase, and they typically are validated as a result of some animal data. So in terms of the rat and swine data in comparison to the gold standard human, we find different values between the control and the treated. And that's fine as long as those differences are somewhat correlated or related to the human study. So in the human study, we see about a 70% reduction. That reduction isn't quite reflected in the swine study, maybe slightly closer in the rat study. And in the in vitro test, what we found is that when we initially did the test at a pH of 1.5, which is the standard for the test, the reduction was definitely not 70%, and we didn't see that correlation of 70% until we raised the pH to 2.5 for these phosphate-treated soils, which is right now kind of recognized as an artifact of in vitro testing for lead in phosphate-treated soils. Another example of phosphate immobilization is the West Oakland Lead Project out in Oakland, California. It's a community-engaged remediation effort to protect children's health. And it was designed and carried out by this individual here, Steve Kalinog, along with Sophia Serta, who's a toxicologist out there, Mel Chen, who's an artist, was involved, and a number of other people as well. And so I provided some guidance on the remedial design for them. But they had a much grander vision for the project just beyond remediating the residential soils, and that included, you know, educating the residents on the harm of lead in homes, as well as safer methods for urban gardening, such as the use of raised beds if necessary. They utilized a sustainable phosphate source as Apatite 2, which is a ground-up fish bone, which is a waste product from the fishery industry, and that was utilized for lead immobilization. They established a worker training program to employ local out-of-work residents to assist with the TLC, or the treat lock cap process, through health and safety training. There was landscape instruction. There was classes on how to operate mechanical equipment, as well as general construction. The TLC process that's listed there is the term that the artist provided to help the community understand what was going on. And the way he explained it was, we add phosphorus to the soil for the treatment, which allows lead then to be locked up. And then we covered the site with just a few inches of clean soil, since these soils are highly degraded, to provide a nutrient-rich layer to get grass to grow. The other thing that was done, as a result of that cap, we were able to do dust suppression through a green cover with lawns, vacant lots, and easements. And then Steve led an effort to further prevent lead exposure by working with the Rebuilding Together Oakland, the City of Oakland Redevelopment Program, in the residential lending section, and the Alameda County Lead Poisoning Prevention Program to address the old peeling lead paint on the exterior of homes. And shown here in the bottom left is an example of one of the backyards that was transformed as a result of this effort. In all cases, grass was kind of the primary objective, but in several cases, residents opted for either a brick patio or some type of a crushed limestone base walkway around the area as well. But as one can see, or if I had more space, I would have showed a before picture, but this is tremendously transformed from what was originally there, and the residents are very pleased with the effort that was conducted. However, other things to consider in doing this is that lead immobilization in the presence of other contaminants hasn't been heavily examined. And many of you know there's sites are often co-contaminated with other elements such as arsenic, zinc, cadmium, or chromium. Arsenic is probably the most prevalent, and arsenate, which is arsenic in the plus 5 oxidation state, is the most common form of arsenic found in soils. The disadvantage of that is that phosphate and arsenate have very similar behaviors geochemically and physiologically. Shown here is an orchard soil that was treated with a variety of phosphate treatments and then assessed using an in vitro bioaccessibility test for lead. And if you look at the untreated sample or untreated plot, we have slightly less than 40% of the lead is bioaccessible. And then after treatment with phosphoric acid, we dropped that down below 5. Apatite 2, which was used in West Oakland, actually slightly enhanced it. Another commercial product here, lockup lead, was about as effective as phosphoric acid. The struvite material is another waste reuse material. This was a USDA collaboration in Florence, South Carolina, where in swine manure lagoons, they were doing a chemical reaction to precipitate out this phosphate mineral, which then left a material that was organically rich as well as nitrogen rich. So then land application of that material could be based on nitrogen rates rather than phosphorus rates, a very ingenious thought process. And then diammonium phosphate is a common agricultural fertilizer. Now, as you can see, in some cases, lead bioaccessibility was dramatically reduced, in some cases slightly increased. And that goes to the point that one must do bench studies in order to apply this material or to apply this technology out in the field. You have to understand or identify which material, which application rate, what conditions are right in order to be successful. It's not as simple as sprinkling any type of phosphorus out on that soil. Now, in a co-contaminated environment, again, this is the same soil, it's the same treatment, orchard soil that was contaminated with lead arsenical pesticides, we see dramatically different results. In the untreated soil, the untreated control, we only have about 13% of the arsenic is bioaccessible, but in every case of phosphorus addition into that site or into that soil, we see a dramatic increase of lead or of arsenic bioaccessibility, and in some cases going over to 50% for the diammonium phosphate material. And that's a cause for concern, and we need to be aware of that before we do in situ amendments in soils. This is carried over to other sites. This is the samples from the Iron King site in Humboldt, Arizona. In the slag-like material, lead bioaccessibility is already naturally low, only 3.5% of it's bioaccessible, and it drops way down as a result of these 5 phosphate treatments. In the residential areas, which is resulting from the oxidation of the slag material being wind-driven onto the residential soils, lead bioaccessibility becomes tremendously higher, but as a result of phosphate treatment, we can drop that way down. However, again, there is arsenic at this site, and we see the same results as we did for the orchard soil, where phosphorus additions to these soils will dramatically increase the bioaccessibility of arsenic, in some cases, rather dramatically. For example, in the residential area where we had about 5% bioaccessibility, it jumped to over 70% for the phosphoric acid treatment. Again, a very, very big thing that we need to be considering in situ treatments. So the question becomes, what can we do about arsenic at these sites? And shown here is an example of the Barber Orchard Superfund site in North Carolina, in which it was a very innovative orchard site for its time, started in the early 1900s, which they used gravity-fed irrigation to spray the trees. So you had these little carts with lead arsenical pesticides hidden up here in the mountains, and by gravity they slid down the hillside and were sprayed onto the trees, which was a very, you know, broad-scale application, if you will. There was no one there to physically handle a hose to spray the trees. It was a sprinkler system, if you will. So a lot of the material fell onto the soil, and so the soil became highly contaminated with lead and arsenic. The owner decided to sell the site to a home developer and quickly realized that with the contaminated soil that something needed to be done, and the recommendation was to remove the top foot of soil and replace with clean fill. And immediately after starting it, they realized the cost had doubled, and they still hadn't found a landfill to accept the contaminated soil. So my postdoc went down, collected a couple 50-gallon drums of this material for us to do testing on, with the thought is, can we transform the arsenic in this soil in maybe a similar fashion the way we can transform lead with the addition of phosphate to pyromorphite? Is there a particular reactant that can take and transform arsenic into maybe a mineral phase? Or is there potential to occlude arsenic onto the soil particle surfaces? And this idea of occlusion is shown here. If we have a mineral surface with reactive sites, and we have this particular arsenic atom right here, if we add an iron nitrate and a potassium hydroxide solution, we could potentially precipitate this iron mineral called ferrihydrite. And as we go, we start to encapsulate. We start to hide that arsenic that's on the surface, and we can add several successive layers, and it may provide a protective barrier to keep any ecological harm or human harm resulting from that arsenic that's now buried. And this phenomenon is often seen in highly weathered soils, where you can get these banding effects occurring as a result of deposition of new material. And shown here are some results that we've been working on. This again is that orchard soil I mentioned earlier. We're looking at this a little differently, where we have a successive iron treatment. So the first treatment was conducted, we waited a day, we did treatment two, we waited a day, did three, and so on up to eight. Now 8C represents eight consecutive treatments within one day. And what we see here is that with the control, we have about 40% bioaccessibility for arsenic. After one treatment, we drop it almost in half, and by the end of 8 days, we have a 75% reduction in arsenic extractability for this particular soil. And then the 8C, the eight continuous treatments, was slightly higher, not as effective as doing them independently. However, for this particular soil with lead as well, it's not quite a dramatic reduction. We go from about 72% in the control or untreated to about 68% in the eight consecutive treatments. However, this kind of leads to a possibility of doing dual treatments at contaminated sites. So in this case where we have lead and arsenic at this particular site, the option may be to first do iron treatments to sequester arsenic, since these iron treatments are not promoting the release of lead tremendously, and then follow that up with a phosphate treatment to take care of lead. And this is something we have going on in the lab right now. Just a couple of summary slides for the arsenic occlusion. There's several benefits for doing this in-situ occlusion treatment. It's a green chemistry initiative. We're adding iron nitrate and potassium hydroxide, in which the byproducts of the chemical reaction are beneficial to the environment. We provide macronutrients, micronutrients, and then and we also have a calcium input into that as well, which improves soil tilth and cation exchange capacity. We're also exploring the beneficial use of reuse of waste materials. In this case, we have we've made contact with an automotive company, which provided some iron welding fumes, which are naturally nanoparticles in size, for retention of arsenic. And we're also looking at other technologies similar to this occlusion technology of silver nitrate, but other options in which we may be able to co-precipitate that iron arsenic mineral that we were talking about. And of course, another benefit, it's still an in-situ technology, and as a result of that, the costs are relatively low. And we know this is pretty important or quite relevant, because occluded phosphorus is very common in soils around the world. It's the result of phosphorus fixation that we see in highly weathered soils, and it's the reason why farmers need to add fertilizer on a regular basis for phosphorus. Excuse me. So our study plan, we have bench and greenhouse studies underway. We've done the in vitro extractions on several soils. We're in the process now of doing an in vivo animal study for these iron-treated arsenic-contaminated soils with lead. And then as a follow-up to look at the potential extractability of arsenic from these iron-treated soils, we plan to do a greenhouse study with the Chinese break firm just to confirm that this very aggressive hyperaccumulator of arsenic is not affecting the extractability of arsenic in that particular system. So getting towards the end here, just some concluding, you know, some issues to bring up is that if in situ remediation or if in situ immobilization is going to work for a contaminated soil, the metal must be put into a form that is highly insoluble over a large pH range, including that found in the stomach after digestion. And so the questions that come up in terms of getting started if you're going to do this out of the site is understanding which amending agent to use, what application rate, and you need to understand the soil matrix characteristics that may be influenced by pH, oxide concentration, water capacity, and of course time is very important in that situation. Now once you, and as a result, as I mentioned earlier, highly recommend doing bench and greenhouse pot studies followed by some of those simple in vitro extraction tests and other extraction tests as well. Now, I think it's very important, and I think a number of other people on the phone would agree as well, that we need to verify the results. And in doing so, we need to identify and quantify a change in speciation, and we need to demonstrate a significant reduction in bioavailability. And these two points are very key for in situ remediation. One of the things we can do is make an attempt to link speciation with bioavailability. And in doing that, we can measure the speciation of the contaminated soil, and then after we treat the soil with the hopes that we can identify a change in speciation, take these two soils, feed it through an animal feeding study with the hopes that the metal bioavailability in the treated soil is significantly lower than that in the contaminated soil. So this is a very simplified diagram of how we would approach it. For our speciation work, we work at the Advanced Photon Source at Argonne National Lab. This is a synchrotron radiation facility. It's probably the most powerful research center in the Western Hemisphere. And what we can, you can get a feel for the size of this facility because that's a car right there, if you can see that little speck. It's a truly impressive facility. They have a center here dedicated to nanoscale research, and there's a guest house here on site, so you can stay on site. Access to this facility is free. You gain access through general user proposals. A night at the guest house is $60, so it's a reasonable research endeavor to take on if you decide to do so. The technique that we commonly use is X-ray absorption spectroscopy, and in this instance we're measuring the energy dependence of the X-ray absorption coefficient of a core level of a selected element. And what happens is energy is ramped up with a monochromator, and all of a sudden you hit a particular binding energy in which every element has a binding energy at that particular energy. And this oscillation is referring to that interaction of backscattering photoelectrons. Now, the spectra can be divided into two regions. We have Zanes, which is the X-ray absorption near-edge structure, and the XFs, which is the extended X-ray absorption fine structure. We can typically look at elements heavier than aluminum. Some cases, we can get all the way down to boron as well. And it's a valence probe. The Zanes portion here gives us information on the chemical state and formal valence. Slight shifts of this peak can allow us to identify quite easily the difference between arsenic-5 and arsenic-3. And even going into more detail, you can distinguish between arsenic-3 sulfur bonds versus arsenic-3 oxygen bonds, for example. In the extended portion, we can gain information on the atomic species, the interatomic bond distances, and the number of neighboring atoms around the selected element. The concentration detection limits are relatively low, 1 ppm for Zanes, 10 ppm for XFs, which is usually not a problem for the contaminated soils that we look at. The best part about synchrotron techniques is that we can utilize the samples in situ. There's no need to put it under vacuum. There's no need to dry the sample. Samples can be solutions, liquids, amorphous solids, soils, plant roots, anything that you can think of can be placed right in the path of the beam for analysis. And another option that can be employed is we can use a variety of spot size. So some spot sizes can be as large as 2 or 3 centimeters, or we can focus it down using platinum-coated mirrors to hundreds of nanometers, depending on the type of analysis that you'd like to conduct. Our bioavailability and bioaccessibility research is conducted in North Carolina. The in vivo studies are led by Dave Thomas, and the objective here is that we're trying to look at, this is for arsenic, where we have separate recovery of urine and feces. For lead, it's a matter of measuring blood lead or gathering a particular tissue like kidney or bone. Relative bioavailability is the ratio of the absolute bioavailability in the soil to the absolute bioavailability of a diet containing either sodium arsenate for arsenic or lead acetate for lead. And then those ratios determine the percent relative bioavailability. For the in vitro studies, one can do a number of available models are out there. Some are single phase or just gastric phase, and some are dual phase where you have a gastric phase followed by an intestinal phase. And the same process or same premises as before, you put a gram of soil into 100 milliliters of solution or some other ratio. It's usually kept at close to body temperature, it's shaken for an hour, and you're measuring the amount of metal that's extracted in that particular time period divided by the total contaminant to determine the percent bioaccessibility. And shown here is the correlation that we've achieved for arsenic bioavailability in soils, looking at the mouse RBA model that Dave Thomas uses in North Carolina, and the in vitro bioaccessibility test that Karen Bradham has developed for arsenic. And this allows us to gain a better prediction of bioavailability for risk assessment. And by developing correlation models like this, we can then move away from animal feeding studies to have a validated in vitro bioaccessibility test for arsenic in this case that can then be plotted into this equation, determine RBA for potential risk assessment at a particular site. And this model works quite well, or is correlated quite well, where we have a very reasonable slope of 0.8, we have a very low intercept, and a very good R-squared value. So in summary, for lead immobilization, it's been successfully demonstrated in soils on some occasions, and in some occasions it hasn't worked well. It's important to confirm the formation of lead phosphates. We utilize synchrotron techniques. There's other spectroscopic methods that could be potentially utilized. It's essential to conduct in vitro and in vivo studies to provide evidence of reduced bioavailability. And in terms of lead, there's other issues to consider. The effects of lead on mobility in soil. Some people worry about plant uptake, which is typically not an issue for lead. Co-contaminants can be a large concern, as we demonstrated with arsenic. And whether it's lead, arsenic, or whatever other metal you're looking at, should be some basic requirements to look at the long-term efficiency and requirements if there's needed for repeated amendments to enhance retention of the metal in the soil environment. And one should evaluate expenses of alternative methods just to make sure. And of course, there's always potential hazard and regulatory concerns with increasing the loading of phosphorus in a local environment, particularly if you're near a watershed, so be cognizant of that. And of course, education and acceptance by the community regarding phosphate immobilization is quite necessary in order to make the process as easy as possible. In terms of arsenic, there's been very limited immobilization studies conducted to date. And as with lead, it's very important to confirm a change in speciation is occurring. There's yet to be an in vivo or animal feeding study on arsenic-treated soils to demonstrate a reduction in arsenic bioavailability, and we're working on that right now. And the question becomes, too, we haven't been able to demonstrate it yet, but do in vitro tests for arsenic soils that have been treated, either with iron or some other amendment, show the same artifacts that we found in the lead in vitro studies, in which we had to increase the pH in order to show a correlation to animal models that we had provided. So my recommendation overall, you know, proceed with caution and common sense. It's a very tricky road to go down, but as I mentioned, you know, go to the lab, go to the greenhouse, and make sure you're conducting something that's relevant to the site that you're working at. And I believe that's all I have. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Kirk. We had a number of questions come in while you were speaking.
Okay.
Before we move to the questions, I just want to check in. We have one more presenter, Roger Hoogerheide from Region 8. Could you speak up if you're on the phone line?
I'm on the phone. Can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you great. So, Roger, I'm going to give a question to Kirk, and while I'm doing that, I'm going to make you a presenter, at which point you'll be able to see how you can move through your presentation using the arrows that will show up in the bottom left corner of your screen. So anyway, hold on, and I will take care of that, but let's give Kirk a question to talk about before I get to that. So, Kirk, we got a question about someone who looked at bioavailability of lead at a site, residential yards at a mining site in Montana, and they found that the lead was basically, I guess it had a, it wasn't as bioavailable, the bioavailability must have been less than what is in the, used to estimate the EPA screening level of 400 ppm.
Okay.
However, basically, they had gotten a recommended cleanup level of 1,000 ppm lead based on the bioavailability measurements that they had done. However, I guess when it came to making the policy decision, both the state agency and EPA wanted them to use, made them use the 400 ppm cleanup level. Is there anything you can share with regards to measuring the actual bioavailability and using it in determining soil cleanup levels?
I think it's an avenue that we're going to have to go down, and I think it's essential because in that case, for example, probably millions of dollars was wasted in cleaning up that site that was unnecessary. However, it needs to be demonstrated quite clearly that there's that significant of a reduction, and I think, you know, in that case, if for a contaminated site, you can do the in vitro extraction test, but I think you would have better luck convincing a site risk assessor or the state if you had animal data in hand to demonstrate that.
Okay.
And so, you know, I think the potential to adjust, you know, for site-specific bioavailability adjustments for cleanup standards is likely an avenue that we'll have to move towards down the road.
Right. Okay, here's an interesting question that I think comes up a lot. This person wants to know what you would recommend for a community who wants to do an in-situ immobilization, but they can't afford to do all the testing that was discussed. And I guess what they want to know is if there's a certain frequency at which they should reapply amendments, and if there's other amendments that are safer than others to use.
Okay. So that's that's kind of a difficult question to answer. Cause, like I said, I think it's essential to be able to do bench and greenhouse studies.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like, you know, if a community's already identified that the soil is contaminated, more than likely some state regulator knows about it or a regional EPA person is aware of it. There's potential to, you know, tie in with maybe a state university to work with them to conduct the studies. There's some potentials in those areas as well. You know, it's essential to kind of go down that road where you're checking off all the marks where there's a variety of amendments tested to demonstrate an effective reduction of metal extractability. And I know cost is always an issue. However, these in-situ remediations tend to be tremendously cheaper than a dig-and-haul alternative.
Right. Yeah, you might have more costs up front to try to determine what you have and what you should do, but there really is no way to determine what you should add if you don't know what you have or what the bioavailability is.
Correct.
Let's see. Someone wants to know if you have any experience with wastes that have both selenium and arsenic contamination.
My only experience in that area is with some drinking water treatment residuals. I'm not sure if they want a follow-up to that or not, but it's kind of a same situation where they're both arsenic and selenium can be oxyanions, and so they would have some competitive effects with other oxyanions. So that's kind of the issue with arsenic and phosphorus in the system that I described, is that they both have that similar chemistry, and that follows suits with sulfate as another example, or silica, which can interfere or compete for adsorption sites within a soil matrix.
Okay. Okay. So, Roger, have you seen that I have given you presenter rights, and you have some arrows in the bottom left? Yeah, there you go. Okay, so I think that we'll move on to Roger's presentation, where he's going to – this is Roger Hoogerheide, who's an RPM in Region 8 in the Montana office. And what Roger's going to do is present some background information and basically some site issues that he's come has with his site. And then we're going to have a discussion with both of the presenters that we had today. And then we also have Rufus Cheney and Sally Brown on the line, where Roger has some questions that he wants to ask them about some remediation strategies. So if you're ready, go ahead, Roger.
Yes, can everybody hear me?
Yeah, you sound great.
All right, this particular presentation, I got 10, possibly 11 slides, so it's not a lot, and most of the slides are going to be pictures, and I'll talk off of the pictures. These two particular pictures on the first slide, the one on the left is a campground on the Upper Dry Fork Belt Creek, which is part of the Barker-Hughesville Mining District. There are Forest Service campsites that are interspersed with some private property throughout the Dry Fork floodplain. The one on the right, that is the Silver Dyke Mill, and that's at the Carpenter Snow Creek MPL site. And at this particular mill, it operated from 1921 to 1929. It, on average, there was about 500 tons of tailings a day that resulted from the milling operations. This isn't a good picture, but you can see from the topography, this is on a very high hillside. And what they did on this particular mill was they basically just dumped the tailings over the side of the hill, and they constructed a dam laying logs end to end, and then used smaller trees to fasten the dam at a right angle at every 10 feet. Between 1921 and 1925, they had basically built this dam. By 1925, it was 90 feet high, about 200 to 300 feet across. In July of 1925, there was a series of earthquakes in the northwestern part of the United States. As a result of those earthquakes, the impoundment dam breached, and all those floodings went down into the basically the Carpenter Creek down below, and I got a couple of slides on that later on. So most of the mines, this is basically a lead-zinc mining district, both of them. Some silver was produced in the 1880s, and in the Snow Creek drainage as part of the Carpenter Snow Creek mining site, there was some gold mines as well. Both of these sites became Superfund sites in 2001, and I say approximately 50 abandoned mines have been identified. Actually, about 100 abandoned mines have been identified in both of the mining districts. About 50 of them will require some type of remediation. These are basically some photos of some stream site investigations, and both of these photos are in the Dry Fork Belt Creek of the Barker-Hughesville Mining District. That number, the 2,000 field measurements taken, basically what we've been doing, because both of these sites as part of the Superfund process are in remedial investigation, so we're still trying to characterize nature and extent of contamination at these sites. So when I say almost 2,000 field measurements have been taken, basically what we've been doing is using a portable XRF, and we've been screening most of the samples in the field, and approximately 10% of those samples have been submitted to the lab for validation of the XRF analysis. We've taken samples both at depth, at surface. Most of the surface samples had been taken at 0 to 6 inches, but because I have both a human health and an ecological risk assessor who has data needs, we do have campsites. If we were taking samples in campsites, the samples were taken at 0 to 2 inches. In addition to the surface samples, we've also conducted some test pits. And as you can see in the photo on the right, you have basically a track hoe in there going down, digging test pits. In the Dry Fork Belt Creek floodplain, we found contamination down to about 3 feet. These are some pretty good aerial photos, and I want to acknowledge Kirk Coover, who's my hydrogeologist for CDM Smith, for uncovering these. But basically what they show, these are of the Upper Dry Fork Bell Creek in the Barker-Hughesville Mining District. There was a flood event in 1953, and as you can see, from the flood event, the difference from 46 to 53, the nature and extent of depositional areas as a result of that flood. And then almost 60 years later, that last photo was actually taken in 2011. You can still see areas that are denuded as a result of that flood from 1953. This is not a very good photo, and I apologize, but this is basically an investigation that was done in 2011, and this is the results of the sampling we did last year of those area photos that were in the previous one. The samples, the third to the right as well as the third to the left, those are campground samples, so those were taken at 0 to 2 inches. And then there's one in the middle that's also a campground sample. So as you can see, within this particular area where we do have tailings, you have several campsites. One of the campsites, the third one to the left, actually has lead at about 6,600 parts per million. This particular figure right here is, I had mentioned that in 1925 the dam had breached at the Carpenter Snow Creek tailings impoundment. As a result of that, those tailings went down Carpenter Creek. Anything in red are tailings basically that are greater than 6 feet at depth. The kind of the orange are 1 to 6 feet. You see a gap between this tailings investigation. After 1925, when the dam broke, they were able to condemn some flat land. And that's basically that gap between those two is the condemned land. And what they did after 1925 was they slurried all of their tailings down, and you have two impoundments that are not shown on this particular slide. Those two impoundments we estimated have about 250,000 cubic yards of contaminated tailings, and then the streamside tailings that are a part of this figure is about another 250,000 cubic yards. In addition to the investigation, we also put a party under order to do a non-time critical removal action. And these photos are the before and after of the Block P mine cleanup. And this particular cleanup is in the Barker-Hughesville Mining District. But as you can see, The before picture, a lot of the historical structures, unfortunately, had to be removed in order to get to the contamination, but you can see the difference between the photo taken in July of 2000 and then the one taken in October of 2012. We've completed the evaluation of all the known abandoned mines where we feel that we're going to be doing remediation, and that's the 50 mines that identified in the previous. At those mines, we've taken soil sediment and water samples, and in addition to taking those samples, we also looked at the physical and chemical hazards associated with these mines. As you can see in the photo in the bottom right, you can see dilapidated buildings. That's a physical hazard. The photo on the bottom of the left, that is an open mine shaft that has been fenced. However, at a lot of these sites, we found portals that had collapsed that have no protection. We found several mine shafts that were open with no fencing around them. And in one instance, we actually had a stope that had collapsed, and a bull elk had actually fallen into that stope. These are just basically some photos for everybody to get an indication of the topography that we're dealing with. All of these mines that are photographed here, they are in very remote locations. It's depending on whether or not we can get a key to the lock to get up to this particular area. It could be anywhere from a 1.5 to 4 mile walk just to get to some of these mines. And all of these mines identified here are probably mines where we will probably do treatment in place. The logistics that we're dealing with, the one on the top left as well as the bottom right show pictures of added discharges. In all likelihood, we're going to have to do some type of passive treatment of those added discharges and somehow divert that water around these tailings, and then we're going to have to put some type of soil amendments and try to get grasses and forbs to grow on these particular areas as part of our reclamation efforts. In addition to the investigations, we have some interim measures that we're going to implement in 2013. And in particular, because we have multiple adit discharges, and in one particular adit, we have we take grab samples, so just view it as a grab sample. The zinc concentrations coming out of that particular adit is about 220,000 parts per billion. And so some of the things that we're looking at is construction of some wetlands to see whether or not, as part of the feasibility study, prior to issuing a record of decision, to see whether or not we can passively treat some of the acid mine drainages that are coming out of these sites. The other thing, and we were very lucky this past July to be able to see a storm event, and the photo on the bottom left, this is actually the lower Carpenter Creek tailings, and you can see basically what's coming off of those tailings as a result of this thunderstorm that we were able to document. The photo on the right shows Carpenter Creek entering Belt Creek, which is the main stream in this particular area. You can kind of see the sediment load that's coming in there. And right here, I highlight the sample that we took just before it reaches Belt Creek. And really what is striking for me on this is the suspended particulate matter and how it binds up the metals. So we have very low dissolved metal concentrations as a result of this storm event, but we have significantly high total metals. And just to give you an indication of what a normal sample on this particular sampling location would be, in June of 2011, total metals on this particular location, lead was 33 parts per billion instead of the 10,800 identified on this particular slide. And that's the basis of my presentation. And with that, I had a couple of questions which I submitted to Michelle, and I'll just have Michelle read those.
Sure. Yeah, so Roger has some questions for our panel here. You know, at this point, I would welcome Sally Brown and Rufus Cheney to take your phones off mute, and also, I guess, Mark and Kirk, since you might have put yourself on mute. So as Roger said, he had submitted a few questions to me, and I guess I'll just start with the first one. As these sites move into feasibility study and remedial design, what are the limiting factors of the soils to seed germination and plant establishment that will need to be considered? So this question is for all of our presenters in this two-part series. So who wants to jump in?
Seems like a good question for Rufus.
That's what I was thinking.
And Rufus and I have had some conversations, and he's well aware that all we've really done is look at metals. We have not really looking at the soil composition, and Rufus, you can kind of ding me on that if you want.
Okay. So Rufus, if you dialed into the conference line, you'd have to hit #6 on your phone pad in order to unmute your line, since we globally muted everyone.
Am I in now?
Yeah.
You're in now.
Okay. The he hadn't measured some of the soil properties, but because, as I explained in last week's webinar, these zinc-lead ores often are rich in pyrite, which generates acidity. And when a site is barren, it's often because of zinc toxicity coupled with low phosphorus availability and, of course, all the other nutrients. So we've been able to show in many sites across the country and around the world that even we could revegetate this site. It may not be acceptable for, certainly not children's exposure, but maybe Mark's work would have to say you'd need to do some small mammal testing because of the very high lead that might be left in the soil surface. But we could make it safe for wildlife food chains because cadmium zinc ratio is low. But we, commented, we might have to make it calcareous, that is pH 7.5, so that the zinc is bound to the soil, the cadmium is bound to the soil, and there's not excessive amount taken up by the plants. So usually we can remediate enough to achieve effective revegetation to cease erosion and to protect the wildlife at the site. The direct soil ingestion of lead may become the most limiting factor in the decision for that particular site. But not all of the site was 10,000 lead. A lot of it was less. And the in situ might be perfectly acceptable for much of the areas you were showing us.
Okay. Okay. So I'll move on to Roger's next question. To what degree should organic matter be composted before it can or should be used? And what are the key features that determine the quality of the organic matter? Is there a difference to consider when applying compost in a floodplain versus the overburden?
There are two different aspects of composting. If you're starting with manure or biosolids, so give you a low-cost organic matter. If you're going to put it in a stream, people would prefer composting so there's no pathogens going into the stream. That's what we did at Leadville, Colorado. Everything within, I think, 10 feet of the stream had compost amendment rather than biosolids amendment. The other side of this is one that we haven't talked about much, and that is the effect of an organic amendment on leaching of metals. If you take a highly biodegradable amendment like manure, during its biodegradation, it generates low molecular weight organic materials that can solubilize metals, even at pH 7.5. And so if receiving water of leachate would be a problem, then having it composted, even low-tech composting, would alleviate that potential of increasing the leaching. On the other hand, making it calcareous can reduce the leaching so much that it isn't really important in terms of protecting the general environment. The pH is the overriding variable in reducing leaching of zinc from a soil profile and other metals, and also in phytotoxicity. I think that addresses that.
Okay. I know we're gone over the 4 o'clock time frame. I just want to check in and make sure that's okay with our panel and with Roger, because I'm certainly willing to keep the line open and to get to the last two questions. So I guess if anyone has a conflict, let me know. And I have been getting messages from Sally that she's having issues with the phone line, so I will try to work that out with her as we move into the next question. So Roger's next question is, how important is the use of woody material to roughen a floodplain to provide initial resistance to erosion?
I'll take a stab at that.
Okay.
It's not
certainly
not my expertise, but I think that the woody materials is very valuable. It gives you microhabitats. Not only does it slow the water on the surface runoff, but it effectively gets microhabitats that are really important. Can you hear me?
Yeah, there seems to be some issues with the audio. I don't know if
that's all right.
Is related to being past 4 o'clock, but
okay.
Try to keep talking more.
Okay. Obviously, when you're doing like a stream restoration, they use as much of the large woody material as they can to create habitat for fish and for other things, not only to slow water movement and erosion and stabilize, but to actually create habitat. you'd have effectively the same thing occurring terrestrially. It's and with equal importance. And looking at it just very simplistically as well, if you talk to people who've done terrestrial restoration projects, typically what they'll say as part of their presentation is that they had the heavy equipment operators come in and do the land surface, which they're trained traditionally to create smooth surfaces. That's, you know, making a cap on a landfill, nice and smooth and everything else. And then whoever's doing the presentation on habitat recreation says to the bulldozer operator, okay, go down and do some donuts in it and spin your bulldozer around a few times. For exactly that reason of creating rough surface, microhabitat, just physically. So having said all that, the short answer is, yeah, I think it's very important for creating the microhabitat, slowing water, and effective restoration.
Let me add to that. There's another aspect, and that is with biodegradable organic matter is a nitrogen source. If it has a large amount of nitrogen, like manure as opposed to compost, you can, by adding the woody materials, you feed the bacteria that will use up that nitrogen rather than let it become nitrate and leachate. So we try to put a particular carbon-nitrogen ratio of the product on the surface. And the last part of it is we sometimes we're able to remediate. If it's only a shallow depth of contamination, we can use surface-applied organic amendment, organic plus limestone and other amendments as needed for the site. And there it's important that we have fibrous material, call it woody, call it rough, a twiggy compost. Don't sieve a compost fine the way you would for a garden. Leave it rough. That way it is not subject to erosion. It'll hold it on the hill until the plants become fully established, and then the plants, of course, hold the hillside as soon as the compost is solve the toxicity problems. So there's different aspects, but in each case, as Mark suggested, it's going to be beneficial for the remediation and effective use of the site by wildlife.
This is Sally.
Yes, we can hear you, Sally.
There's a whole range of products in the compost industry that let you put compost so it doesn't run off or wash away in difficult terrain. So there are, you can get compost comes in rolls, you can get compost in blankets. It's not quite the company store, but it's not that far away. And so you can also use, these are going to be more expensive than directly blowing or dosing compost onto slopes or into a waterway, but these types of things can be used intermittently as safeguards. So you can spray a compost or push compost down a slope, but you can also, at different points on that slope, put some of these compost rolls down that'll effectively work to catch any material that may try and move down a slope. And these have been used extensively in DOT applications and been really effective. So I would imagine they would translate well. And now nobody's talking.
Michelle, it's yours again. Oh, no. Now we don't know what happened.
Oh, well. You know, we tried. I finally got online. Anyway.
I'm still here.
Okay. We have no idea.
Well, I can read the next question then.
Okay, go ahead, okay. Kirk.
When developing performance measures, what are the most important measures of revegetation/reclamation success? And can you provide the participants any examples of acceptable field procedures that are currently being used?
So. Personally, I think one of the most beneficial is actually probably one of the most simple, which is simply percent cover. If you go to some of the other things, we had with, if you're doing more in-depth things like, say, community structure, species richness, those kinds of things, they're useful, but you have to have a lot of time because the system is changing. It starts with whatever you plant, whether it be a single species, two species, or a seed mix, and then it adjusts itself to whatever is adapted for living in that particular area, given the rainfall and everything else that happens where you actually are. So you're going to have years of transition of basically non-steady state in the species diversity and composition at the site, which gives you some difficulty. Whereas if you're just looking at percent cover, that's going to tell you about erosion. It's going to tell you about the ability of the area to sustain plant growth. It's going to tell you a great deal, and it's very easy to do. So that actually, if I had to pick one thing to do with plant communities, I would probably pick that one. Sally, would you agree with that?
Yep, that would make sense.
And what was the second?
You know, we had your whole presentation. I'm listening to your whole presentation, Mark, and the whole point is we got things green, and then the question became, is this an ecological nuisance? Is it safe? And there's a whole lot of work that's gone behind and into, is it safe? It's green, is it safe? And basically the answer, you know, take advantage of what work has been done, because the short answer is if it's green, for a lot of these sites, it's safe.
The only sites that we can't say that unequivocally are sites that are molybdenum or selenium, highly contaminated, like from a mine source, or a site that the one that Mark showed of a nickel-cadmium battery factory. There's a large amount of cadmium and no zinc, and you can poison anything with that cadmium. But where it's a zinc mine, lead mine, the cadmium zinc ratio is such that you, if you protect it from zinc poisoning, the cadmium uptake is trivial and no longer a risk to the wildlife.
Yep.
So if it's, kind of like that, if it's green and it's a normal zinc-lead copper mine waste site, smile and know you've done a job of protecting the environment.
Was that the entire question, Kurt, or was there another aspect to it?
That was essentially it. And then I just received an email from Michelle. She lost the ability to speak online, and she asked me to cover the other questions that are listed. There's one question about how do you determine metal species, and I could cover that quite easily. In fact, under the files section of the CLUIN webpage, there's a document there for 2005 DeMore et al. It's a review article on metal speciation techniques in soils, so that'll be a good resource if anyone wants to look there. And then we had another question. Are there sites where these techniques compose complete remedies for surface as well as subsurface contamination? I know most of the work that I try to accomplish tends to focus mainly at the surface, trying to hinder human contact. But do you guys have any examples of subsurface treatments?
I think Sally's work at Leadville tells the other side of that. There are some mine waste deposits that were acidified 3 or 4 feet down at the pH 2.5. And those sites are going to be leaching and toxic until the depth is neutralized. So in that case, they actually use construction discs to incorporate limestone, 100 tons per acre of limestone, to the bottom of the mine, tailings deposit depth. And that way it became a stable site that was not going to cause future leaching to poison fish in the stream and so on. Most sites are... Go ahead.
I think USGS did a lot of sampling at depth in Leadville, and Mark may remember this better than I do, but I think that they did not find a whole lot of movement of the metals down through the soil profile. And whether you're going to see movement of metals is going to depend on the rainfall at the area, as well as the transpiration demand of your crop. So in the Montana site that we were looking at, those are going to be pretty dry sites. So if it's precipitation coming through, that's not going to be a concern. It's going to be more subsurface flow, and whether you have subsurface flow that's a concern.
Yeah, and that's the from my perspective and what I've seen is yeah, if you have really deep tailings deposits, you can do some good over time. You're primarily treating the upper portion. But then the other thing to consider is whether or not through that revegetation process and amendment process, can you do anything else to change water flow patterns? If you have subsurface water that's coming up into your tailings from beneath, you're in a bad place. It was just a bad place for that stuff to be, and there's a problem. If you're controlling infiltration from rain and precipitation events, then your reestablishment of a soil is going to at least have some positive effect because that's going to hold some of that water up. You're not going to have that rapid flow of that rainwater and snow melt all the way through. The plants and the soils are going to hold at least some of that water up and at least reduce that percolation through the bulk tailing deposit.
Evapotranspiration. Plants are going to... on a dry site, use most of the water that rains onto it.
Okay.
Hi, everyone. This is Michelle. I'm back. I'm sorry about that. Thank you, Kirk, for doing such a fine job. I could hear you on the audio from the Adobe Connect.
Let me make one more point about the surface versus deep. If we had all our druthers, we'd rather have a foot of compost amended soil depth so we've got a good rooting zone so that the plants have a really good chance of being persistent. Again, depending on how deep the contamination is, we don't have to have such a deep incorporation. And as at Bunker Hill, the mountainside was dealt with surface application alone, so that different kinds of contamination lead to different options for remediation.
Mm-hmm. So I just want to check in. I know that we've run over a little, and I know that there's a few more questions here. But I certainly don't want to make anyone stay on any longer. I guess, does the panel want to take more questions, or do you want to answer them offline? How do you guys feel?
People have been on for over two hours. They may be ready to do some offline questions.
Okay, so why don't we tell our participants, if you want to email your questions to any of the particular presenters, all of their contact information is available on the main seminar page, which is the top link of the related URLs that you see under the Clue-In logo. I want to thank everyone for a very lively discussion today, and Roger, I hope that if you would like to have some follow-up conversations, that if you would like to do that, need any help with facilitation, I'm certainly here to help you. You certainly have everyone's contact information. And then also, I would like to ask everyone, if you haven't already, to click on our feedback form, which is on our final slide today, and let us know what you think. I've been speaking with Jean Ballant, and we thought about trying to do more webinars in this format where we present a site and site issues and have panel experts talk about the topic specific to, what someone's dealing with right now. So let us know how you like that format. Obviously, we'll have to work on the whole time constraint and agenda for this.